Hello, everyone. We have a slightly different kind of chill rant for this week. Lauren actually managed to step out of her bunker for a little while to have a, I guess you could say, a more personal conversation. Well, personal slash professional. It's a little different from what we usually do in the regular pod. It's not quite as analytical, and it's a little bit more freeform in the way that my chill rants tend to be. So I thought you guys might appreciate not having to listen to me, just me for 1 week. So here it is.
まもなく特急ポット浄土行きが到着します。黄色い線までお下がりください。
So as I'm telling you this as a professional, in that I really enjoy listening to you because I need to listen to someone who is speaking to the me. I don't know if I'm gonna repeat it correctly, I'm not gonna lie. But I need to listen to someone who's speaking to the me that games needs, not the me that games has made.
Okay. And who are those people?
Yeah. And so the first person, the one that games, actually, if you are coming from games, I'll start with who games has made me. So I love listening to GMTK because his videos truly are from the perspective of someone who is playing a video game. You know that it's a video game. You are playing the game. You are analyzing the game, right, for what it is. And who games has made me is someone who can look at a piece of a game and critically, you know, analyze it. And I can play it for 30 minutes and I can pretty much see every single system that that game is going to have. Unfortunately, then as a writer, I can also sometimes see then what the story would be for that game, depending on like the entire length, right? Yeah. But that's why I play the game, because I want to be surprised by the systems. I want to be surprised by the mechanics. But games has made me someone who is a game designer. I'm someone who's looking at the game. I'm a gamer, so I'm only looking at it as if it's isolated. Games has made me someone who is looking at games as an isolated medium that has no other cultural impact or milieu or influence from other industries. And that's incredibly important.
It's sort of a weird kismet that you should mention this, because I spent a lot of time today trying to find a way to play and or watching videos of what is the full title again? Star Wars Rogue Squadron 2 Rebel Leader or Rogue Leader or something like that. It has a really long Rogue Squadron 2. And one of the things that I sort of vaguely remembered in my mind about that game is, and what makes it unlike literally all Star Wars games that preceded it and then basically informs all the Star Wars games that follow, is that the game is sort of designed to immerse you in the world of the films in the way that, say, like, you know, the Battlefronts games do. It's sort of like it takes a general idea or a general story arc from one of the films, and then it like literally uses dialogue, it uses characters. And in the case of Rogue Squadron 2, it actually uses footage from the films, from the original trilogy films, and it intersperses them. So it's literally like this game exists with not just within the like sort of the broader Star Wars universe, but it's literally playing towards like your nostalgic feelings about the films themselves by sort of like immersing you in them. And sort of there's this weird, and the reason why I say this is sort of like oddly kismet is because this is something that games already do. Like, they already put you in that sort of broader milieu that you're talking about.
But no, they absolutely recognize. Yep. No, I don't think they recognize it. And I love that you use the word kismet, because I mean, perhaps unbeknownst to you, kismet is the scripting language of Unreal Engine.
I did not know that. I mean, I know a little bit about Unreal Engine, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a turbo.
No, but that's perfect, is because games has made me someone who goes, oh, right. Kismet is a word that existed and predated game engines.
Yeah.
But the what games teaches you, right? And this is why I think that games can get isolated and unfocused on the world around them, and some can also create maybe a culture where it really just is centered around the game, right? Because games create a world with morality and ethics and these systems and rules that you need to follow in order to succeed in that world. And once you succeed in the world, right, usually the game is over, you've won it, maybe you've gotten the high score, or you just exist in it and it's pretty and you never finish it, say like Breath of the Wild, which does have an ending, right? Or Animal Crossing, right? There are milestones for you to achieve and there are systems and this world and it's understandable. And it's all within the context of the game. And so games as an industry then, right, is all about creating these contextual experiences where that you grow and you succeed, but it's contextualized just to the game, contextualized just to Unreal Engine. So everyone out there, if they're listening to this, that immediately goes, Kismet, does he mean a Kismet? Like Unreal Engine? Like, boom, you have already fallen for what games are good at, which is getting you to believe in something and forget everything outside.
Well, it's the cult of immersion. Right?
Cult of immersion. I love that. Can we have a t-shirt that says that, please?
cult of immersion. So is that like, what is that in Living Color song? Cult of personality. We have the cult of immersion.
Yes. We have the cult of immersion. No, exactly. And no, but so hold on. But that's who games has made me, right? I am the cult of immersion.
Okay.
I am a person that is focused on just that. And I'm going to tune out everything else. And because of all the game industry shenanigans, I have to tune everything else out. I'm not going to like look at all of the influences that have come like around or centered around.
Yeah.
What games needs is someone who is remembering all the things they did before games, is remembering all of the narrative theory, is remembering all of the, you know, artsy classics literature classes and studying like romance in the time of Hercules. I know like that's a very, I studied classics when I was in
That's fine. I studied classics as an undergrad too, so whatever.
Yeah. Magic and witchcraft, like all my magic books, like actual, like real life magic, not like Harry Potter magic. I mean, we'll go into like what that means. But what I'm saying is like all of these weird like classics books, all of this literary history, all just like narratology, like you would say, right? And you're talking about the third person and different narrations. I mean, it immediately like hit on how like, dang, like, this is what games, when you look at them, say, right as we were starting it, people were coming from books or coming from film or coming from their college classes. And we're looking at it as if this is a first person perspective narrative, and we need to make this a first person perspective camera.
Yeah, because the terminology is literally just transported from one to the other.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it is. But what games has made me is it's made me a consumer that is looking at something that is a first person's perspective game or a first person shooter and is looking at the mechanics, but is not looking at how those mechanics tell the story. And what games needs is the me that remembers that games are just a medium of telling and driving that experience and that story, not just like not outside of that.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that that is what I have been looking for when I listen to what your podcasts or when we give our discussions versus like when I listen to a lot of other game critics or game reviewers or game theorists is that they're just looking at the game. They're not thinking about where did this come from? They're not doing the history. I'm not saying that everyone does that, but what I am saying is that that's what games has made me. I've forgotten it. I'm just going, let's look at Ghost of Tsushima and let's just analyze it and play it. And oh, what a fun experience, right?
Yeah.
When you step back, you're like, wait a second. The only reason why this works is because people in a boardroom were like, we're not making a game. We're making a film that as a game.
To that point about sort of like the cloistering effect of like the kind of person that like the industry sort of like crafts you into becoming. So when I actually did my rant about Ghost of Tsushima, I was actually more forgiving than I think I should have been. Because I started reading some interviews with the devs from Sucker Punch about the game. And frankly, they grossly misrepresent a lot of things. Like, in fact, in one of the interviews, one of the devs said that, like, you know, one of the reasons why we decided to do the story the way we did is because the historical record is really spotty. And I'm like, no, it's really not. Like, it's not spotty at all. I mean, it's not probably the most, like, detailed in terms of like documentation in like Japanese history, but you have like sources both in Chinese and in Japanese about the Mongol invasions. And in fact, you know the names of all the primary commanders. By the way, none of those names appear in the game, including the actual historical battle that they reenact at the beginning of the game. Like, all the names are wrong. Like, none of those people were there. And in fact, a lot of the names that they use would have been from clans from, like, Eastern Japan. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all. And so, like, as a, like, a historical representation, it's really terrible. And sort of, I think there was, I don't know, frankly, a lot of laziness there. As a game, it's great. And sort of, in many ways, like, that's the myopia in a nutshell. Because, again, as a game, it's great. Like, everything that is proper to, like, your training and, like, your personal experience as a game dev, like, that works in the game. But everything that would have to come from somewhere else, that would have to come from historical research or, like, being sensitive about cultural appropriation, or there's this really great article in Polygon about sort of the how, like, samurai stories play into, like, right-wing Japanese politics. Like, all that stuff has to come from the cultural studies sphere. And it's absolutely and precisely for the reason that I think you're pointing out.
No, I mean, cultural studies was like my second major. I mean, that's, I mean, you know that. That's what I got my thesis.
I was there.
You were there. And so not only was I, you know, trained in narration and trained in how to, like, create an amazing, say, like, story, I also was trained in the cultural studies and to do that type of research. And there's something that when you go into games, or when I went into games, we'll frame it to me, because I don't speak for every game developer, right?
Yeah.
But something that I've noticed is that when you are in games, and whether or not you, or rather, no, completely personal, sorry, like, totally backpedaled on all of this. So let's go into a chill rant or something, actually. anyway, so that people can just hear me rant about how I am mixing up my words.
Well, that's actually that's why I wanted to record this, is that I was thinking I actually am going to use it as the next chill rant.
Just anyway,
go ahead. Go ahead. So let's turn for a second to the...
Hold on. I just want to say one thing is, as someone who is, I really believe in formal education. I really believe in higher education. And it doesn't mean you need to go to a Percy school or you need to pay thousands of dollars into debt. It just means you need to learn. Right. Yeah. So whether your formal education is a masterclass that you took on Instagram or whatever, right? Or it's, I can afford these $5 textbooks that I got secondhand that someone else has written in, whatever. I really believe in learning to better yourself. And someone for me that went to the number one party school and was very upset that it was a party school, like, that's, you know, that's who I am. I'm very studious. I was really surprised to have this revelation earlier this week, playing a couple of these new games, recognizing that despite being formally trained, despite being really into cultural studies on my own time, that I, as a designer, it's not that I forgot it, but that I recognize that we just don't really use the cultural studies in our games. And also that games kind of get that pass for not being culturally representative because the game itself is so strong.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized that what we talked about with games needs the me that is culturally strong so that I can, right, represent that culture, or at least kind of show and call out when, hey, there's this whole thing that's being misrepresented. You need to be aware of it. If you're going to do it, but awareness, right, is the key.
Yeah, so, because, well, there is a kind of dismissive attitude that people use whenever those sort of, like, quote unquote, outside critiques are made. I mean, it's always the, well, you know, it's just a game, or, you know, that's just the way it is. There's this sense that somehow, like, you can always compartmentalize gameplay from, like, any broader cultural perspective, which is bizarre. Like, no other medium works this way. Film doesn't work this way. Music doesn't work this way. No one who works in any of those industries thinks that, like, oh no, this is a thing entirely unto itself. No one thinks that way, except, strangely enough, in the games industry.
Yes. And I think that needs to change. I think that, right, games will only succeed further or maybe go beyond what they currently are, is that you can't just say it's just a game. You have to, right, own to what you are representing, because the gameplay itself has a morality mechanic. The morality of Ghost of Tsushima is the standoff mechanic, where it is more moral to challenge your opponent head on. And it is also easier for the player, which means that you will feel more rewarded because it's more efficient, and game mechanics are about being efficient, right?
Yeah.
And then the mechanic of the standoff the ability to do the standoff, the narrative that says I challenge and right look my opponent eye when I kill them.
Yeah.
That is an ethical argument to make versus, right? Yeah. Someone saying, no, just stab them in the back. It's killing. Killing for what killing is versus, no, there is an honorable way to kill, a just way to kill, a better way to kill. It's like, oh my gosh, you're talking about what is the best way to kill someone. You're playing a game. You can't say, oh, it's just a game. It's not making an ethical argument about the right way to kill somebody.
I agree with your analysis. However, I would argue that there's actually something fundamentally wrong about that. Not the analysis. The analysis, I think, is correct. But I think there's something fundamentally wrong about presenting that idea to the player, which is that it plays to this stereotype of like how warrior culture worked in
exactly.
And that's never challenged.
Yeah. And why would it be? Because it's not the fiction of the culture. It's the fiction of the reality of the game.
Yes.
In which
they have
fictionalized the culture.
Yeah.
Right. So not only are they presenting this right mechanic and this moral code, right, as an ethical system within the game that makes it a lot easier to do, they're also saying that it is just, that it is right. And to top it all off, right, they have it, you know, wrapped in the culture of this is just how it was. So it's just nicely handed to the player.
Yeah, it's like a nice little gift.
It's a nice little gift. And I even look at my Twitter feed and they're like, yeah, I just upgraded all the standoff mechanics. And I just like, that's what I did. And I just killed every, you know, thing with a standoff.
Well, because the standoff is a little bit overpowered because it sort of makes you immune for, you know, the duration of the standoff itself.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah,
and that's what I did. And it was perfect, right?
Yeah.
You like sneak in, you observe the leader, you back out, and then you just stand off everybody. And you're like, ha ha ha, I am a true warrior. And it's like, no. Anyway, we don't have to go into it. I need to listen to your other Ghost of Tsushima. So let's move on to what you were saying we were going to move on to.
I like to follow this line of thought, but I actually, no, let's continue with this line of thought because I want to talk more about who the Lauren is that games needs. Like, I think we've covered fairly clearly, like, the person that sort of, like, game design and the games industry has made you into, but let's actually zero in on what are the characteristics of the Lauren that the... I mean, and we're talking about a hypothetical Lauren here. I'm not talking about...
It's just a hypothetical Lauren.
Yeah, sort of like the who is the you that the industry needs? In your
opinion. And this could also be who is the you, the general you as well. Like, who is the general you that the game industry needs? Because, I mean, it's obviously as a game designer, it's personal to me. But yeah, when I look at it, there's someone I definitely used to be with more, I don't want to say ideas or creativity, but there was someone that was constantly looking at the world through this connective tissue lens, right?
Yeah.
Like everything is connected. But I've taken that into games by saying everything is connected via the systems, everything's connected via the story. And that's true in relationship to an engine, to engineers, to UI, to UX, right? It's true in terms of what I do for a living, which was systems design. Right. And which is quite physically, how does engineering translate to a designer that translates to an artist? Or that's one type of systems design, I guess I'll say.
Yeah.
And then how do all the things like interact? How do AIs interact with when a player passes through a space or a volume, you know, etc.?
Yeah.
And rewatching the way The Mandalorian was made is also great because an episode, whatever episode is about technology, they talk about how they use Unreal Engine to create the effects and create this world.
Really?
And also that they build a live volume for the actors to act within and are making, anyway, it's just, I can't actually, I'm not going to say all of things. If you haven't watched the episode, go watch it.
Okay, I think I will actually.
Because they are using video game technology to create The Mandalorian. And Unreal Engine is very powerful. They actually even use VR in some instances to move the camera. But when they started talking about how the actors were in a volume so that the camera, cameraman, not camera, I was about to say camera designer, could move the camera around and they could instantly get perfect lighting because the light source was within the volume already and it could be whatever time of day. But I burst out laughing every time. I've seen the episode three times now. I just can't get enough of it, because that's just what we do in games, is we create a cine set with the perfect lighting and put our actors in it, and then record the camera designer just wise around. And this is important because in games, I am laughing because this is the one moment where film and games are now transitions, where the film industry is looking at something and going, wait, we don't have to go to a location. We can bring the location to us. We can create a fake volume set with all these LED like TV screens.
Yeah.
We can pan the background so that it looks like it's moving, but everyone's staying still. That's a huge trick in video games, just to pan the background, right? So they're doing all these video game tricks, which feel low budget, but are actually super high budget because, you know, it's a bunch of TV screens.
Yeah.
And plus Unreal Engine license, like that's a thing. Right. Plus the film tech.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned sort of now the overlap between sort of games and like film production, because, okay, there's a couple things I want to mention. First, sort of like the generic point, which is that, you know, games, I mean, I know Naughty Dog does this especially, but, you know, games are turning a lot more towards using motion capture. And for the very reason that it'll actually allows the people who are often also the voice actors to do more complete and complex performances that, you know, just like standing in, you know, a studio with a mic in front of you don't necessarily allow for. And so you see this especially in, like, I know they do it in the Uncharted games, and I know they did it a lot in both The Last of Us 1 and 2.
Crystal used motion capture for Avengers as well.
Yeah, so this turn towards, because it's not just about sort of dealing with the uncanny valley problem, which is that oftentimes, like, animated motion in video games tends to feel extremely stiff and weird, and that one of the things that I think like designers have actually learned is that you don't necessarily need more polygons, you don't necessarily need, you know, better, more complex animations. What you need is something that just looks and feels much more like human movement, and sort of like bringing the human element back in, even if it's more low res, like it will read better than a lot of these like extremely high res games that have that sort of uncanny valley effect, precisely because they feel kind of stiff and mechanical. The second point that's related to that is actually something. So for those of you who are not familiar with Oshii Mamoru, who is the very famous Japanese director, most of you probably know the original Ghost in the Shell movie that was one of his. He has this really fascinating essay. I don't know if it's ever been translated. I suppose I can look it up later. But he has this really really amazing essay in which he talks about the fact that, like, in the modern day, all films are a form of animation. And what he means by that is that because of the interaction between sort of like filmed elements, CGI, editing, and all of those things, that, like, it's gotten to such a point now where, you know, you can see this in any of the Avengers films. If you look at the way those, like, the actual, like, on-set shots work, it's literally like, you know, somebody in a costume in front of a bunch of green blocks. Like, that hardly feels like a film set anymore. Like,
they say the volume, sorry to interrupt you. This is why the volume changed things on The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
Season one. Because the volume allowed them to use these really high definition television screens that they hooked up to the computer to create a digital photorealistic set, so that the ground was a set and maybe some of the 3D elements were sets, like the rocks or some crates, right? But they only had to build enough of the set around it. So instead of using green screens or blue screens, they like just put the set on the television. Yeah. It's like filming, imagine filming, right? You've got your 8 plasma TVs on the wall, the dream. And not plasma, like OLED, I guess now, right? Your 8 plasma, OLED, whatever. 4K, 8K, high definition TVs.
I know very
And you're filming in front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Right? And you're filming in front of it. And then when you play that film back to your friends, they're like, whoa, I can't believe you went to Utah. Like, that is the type of, you know, technology we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's why it changed it. Cause it wasn't a green screen that had an uncanny valley. It was, that's a real sunset in that television screen in the far off background. Right. Yeah. That's the real light from the television. Right. Yeah. That is doing the sunrise. And it's on a timer. And so the sun is coming up. And that probably is Unreal Engine's sun is in the background for one of the Mandalorian shots. And it's just like, I'm a light source. I'm just going to keep going. And they're like, oh, wait, we need to retake that. Okay, put the sun down again.
Yeah.
Right? versus, oh, we need to retake that. Oh, and the lighting has changed because it's, you know, the real sun, right? And one I think, more. So hold on. So I guess
yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so I guess that's kind of what I'm, when I look at that intersection, I brought up The Mandalorian, I brought up these filming techniques because like, that's not something I think games, when you get into like a rut in games, that's not really something you would think of. You wouldn't think of, oh, we have this problem to solve. We need to bring in, like we need to bring in human animation. So let's do mocap. You're already doing mocap. You're just getting the human element accidentally. Oh, we need to take reference images on our phones. When you're an animator, you're already doing that, bringing in the human element. You're just getting it accidentally.
So
there's all this accidental development.
So for the purposes of like sort of coming to an argument and making a final point, I think you actually stumbled upon the point that we need to make, which is that the problem is, so in the games industry, as you said, you're getting the human element, but you're getting it accidentally.
Yes.
So in many ways, the reason why the you that kind of got sidetracked needs to come back in is because you not just you in the general sense, but also you, Lauren, as a human being and as a game designer, need to bring that back precisely because you need to actually find that human element deliberately rather than accidentally.
Yep. And the Lauren that game needs is the Lauren that found the human element in the screenwriting and in the play, like the plays that I did. I found the human element in the fans that I had to interview for like my entrepreneurial certificate or whatever. I found the human I found the human in Foucault is what I was going to say, which is a little harsh.
That sounds strange.
But I mean, I found it's not that strange, right? I found the human element, and that's my job as a writer is to find, not so much to find the human element, but to recognize the human element and to deliberately every time successfully, right? I was going to say the word capitalize, and that's not what I mean, but to successfully, I was going to say perform. That's also wrong. There's a word that's like that, but it's
maybe
to
utilize is what you mean.
Utilize, perpetuate, I think, because I mean to continuously and ever expand upon itself.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Right, which is somewhat between both of those. I need to perpetuate the human element deliberately over and over again, because we can't just accidentally stumble upon to success in games. And a lot of games' success, I really do believe, comes from accidental stumbling upon.
All right, that's all for this week. As always, you can follow Lauren at the Lauren Ash on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow me if for some reason you feel like that. My Twitter handle is UAHSENAA. You can also follow the podcast, which is probably the most useful use of your time. That's Futidashi Pod on Twitter. If you like the show, it would really help us out if you rate and review us on iTunes. That really helps with the algorithms and whatnot and pushing us out to more people who might be interested. But with that said, until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and don't let the man get you down. Bye.